thought.
Is that because British people are so ugly?
You guys are mean.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to this week's episode of American Desis. I'm Arjun.
And I'm Akash.
Today, I'm very pleased to have on the show Hernan Lopez. I'm trying to give it that Latino pronunciation.
Hernan.
Yeah. Lopez. Now, this man, I actually just met him a couple weeks ago, but he's a fascinating guy. He was the head of Fox International Channels and then left to now found Wondery, which is going to be, it's a podcast distribution site.
It's
going to
be a... Let this dude tell you. I haven't even let him talk. It's been a minute.
It's been 30 seconds. Everyone, welcome to the program, Hernan Lopez.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Oh, please. So tell us about Wondery. Wondery is a podcast.
It's a podcast network. Okay. We are trying to create and curate quality scripted and real-life audio series and try to bring back to the modern age, to the podcasting age, a lot of the magic that used to happen with radio dramas 70, 80 years ago.
This is a new thing I'm hearing about a lot now, is scripted podcasts, which is, yeah, like you said, like similar to what they always said our grandparents, great-grandparents used to do, listen to like radio shows. It's the same thing, right?
It's very similar. The biggest difference is that 70 or 80 years ago, people were listening in front of a radio that was static in their living room.
Right.
And the TV set came in and replaced the radio because radio dramas were meant and designed to be consumed usually at night and with your family. So there was no reason for you to do that with radio when you could do it on TV. TV had all the audio plus the video.
Right.
It's very interesting that in one country, at least that I know of, in the UK, radio drama continued as a tradition. It continued as a practice. BBC Radio 4 produces about 500 hours, I'm told, of radio drama a year. Most of these is anthologies, so shows that are made for 45 minutes, but they're close-ended. They have a beginning and an end and a plot.
Is that because British people are so ugly?
You guys are mean.
I'm sorry, I thought of that joke and I couldn't resist. And I was like, is Akash not?
That's so normally what I would do. I was thinking, I was like, I'm asking a lot of questions.
You guys are terrible. British people are way smarter than all of us. So you guys,
I mean, I
respect. British people took a lot from India, so I feel like we can call them ugly. You know what I mean?
Look, I mean, I lost my train of thought now. I was talking about BBC Radio Drama 4 and how much they produce. But you know, a lot of what they produce is radio drama that is done in anthology. So single episode, closed-ended, and very plot-driven. Although they do also produce serials, so a series of more than 5 episodes. The limitation, I think the reason why the radio drama hasn't been as popular in the U.S., in many countries, is that you couldn't convince somebody to go and listen to a radio drama in sequence at 9 p.m. every Thursday, right? You couldn't tell...
Because you couldn't record it, you couldn't schedule your life around that.
Exactly.
People weren't choosing to do that.
Exactly, and there weren't DVRs for radio,
exactly.
Right? Just in television had their DVRs, they had the on-demand, but now podcasts essentially are the on-demand. Podcasts are the Netflix of radio. So the opportunity...
That's a good line right there. That in meetings, huh?
The opportunity, it is to create that platform for audio entertainment. Some of it is scripted, but some of it will be unscripted and real-life based. But all of it will have in common that it will be narrative, will be story-based. It will go into characters and it will try to create stories for people to relate to.
Let me ask you a question about the radio dramas that you were talking about in England. Were a lot of those original pieces, or were they like they were gonna do, I don't know, an old
Sherlock Holmes
or something like classic texts that they would then turn into a radio play?
There's both. I've seen an adaptation of all the Noel Coward plays. Agatha Christie plays have been adapted to radio. Huckleberry Finn has been adapted for radio.
Right.
You can go Metamorphosis, the famous Franz Kafka book has been adapted for radio. You can also see original plays that have gone from radio to TV and from radio to the theater.
What do you change when you're taking a book and making it like you always say, adapting it for radio? Because in my mind, that's just an audiobook. But like, what do you do differently when you're adapting it for radio? Like Huck Finn or whatever.
An audiobook tends to be read by one narrator.
Okay, gotcha.
So it takes a lot more concentration and it's less entertaining than when you do in a drama. You have multiple actors act out. You typically have one narrator, not typically, but more often than not, you have one narrator and multiple actors, and they essentially the act, just like you would do on a theater.
It becomes like adapting a book for a screenplay.
It's not
exactly. So there are things that you can do. So for instance, you can go just like in books, you can go much deeper into what the characters are thinking and what they're feeling, you're speaking directly into the listener's brain, because the consumer experience is that you're likely to be in your car, you're likely to have, or if you're not in your car, maybe you're walking your dog, or maybe you're on a long
flight.
We have lives, unlike English people
who are too ugly to go anywhere.
There we go. And you have your earphones, and the voice of the actors and the voice of the narrator is speaking directly into you. And it's creating an image in your mind that is much more authentic than anything that you can reproduce.
Well, it allows the audience to be much more engaged in the story because they're then creating the image. It's like their image is particular to them. So it's not, you know, a creator or like a visual effects person or an actor figuring out like what piece of clothing would speak to you. Personally, it's you deciding like, well, I really, you know, I see this guy in a scarf and like the wind in this way. And like it affects me and it makes it personal so that you have more of a reaction to it.
Absolutely. Alex Blumberg, the host of Startup and the owner of Gimlet, has this great analogy or a great exercise when he gives a course on audio storytelling. He will tell people, describe a situation where he's under a blanket recording a show and ask three people in the audience to imagine what color the blanket was. And each of the three people have a very vivid recollection, very vivid imagination about what color and how otherwise the blanket looks. All of them are wrong, but that particular memory will be stronger for any one of them than if they had seen the actual blanket.
Right. Now, before we there's more questions for Wondery that I want to ask about podcasts in general, but I want to ask you left a very high...
I was just about to ask, man. That's why we work together.
Perfect, man. You were at a very like high position within Fox, and you were running the international channels. You were high, and you left to essentially start something from the ground up.
Right.
That's a huge, like... I don't know if you would say it's a huge risk, but it feels like from the outside like a huge risk.
It is, of course, but you have to bear in mind also the context. I had been at Fox for 18 years, and I loved it. It was the dream job. It was a significant business. I had grown up with the company or my division from the moment I was very small until it grew up to a $3 billion division with 4,000 people. I would travel to any office that we had. We had 60 all around the world, and I could just get in touch with anybody I wanted, get baseball tickets, football tickets, soccer tickets, just you name it, right?
And so you're living that life. You're living a great life.
Yeah, now
except there was a little bit of too much travel, right? I mean, with two kids, you don't really want to be on a plane that much. But one realization I had about 10 years ago was that I really wanted to be an entrepreneur. So I have been daydreaming about having my own company for a long, long time.
What is the appeal of being an entrepreneur?
You are essentially creating something by yourself with a team that could potentially change
the world.
Not the world. I'm not.
You could.
That
I mean,
naive. No, but it could potentially change the way certain kind of experiences by consumers are taken to market. So that's what I'm trying to with Wondery. I'm trying to create or recreate the experience of radio drama for the podcasting age. But the appeal of being an entrepreneur is you work for yourself. You essentially are deciding what to do every day. And when you come to work, who do you meet? Who do you not meet? Who do you associate with? There are some things that when you work for somebody else, your decisions are subsidiary to somebody else's.
So here's my next question is, we talk about like the changing industry a lot. Even if it's not on this podcast, Arjun and I talk about it all the time. Is there something you see changing that's going to be detrimental to television and beneficial to podcasts? Is that why you went to a podcast network?
No, I actually went to podcasts because I see an opportunity in podcasts similar to what I saw in cable television when I started cable television 25 years ago. Back in the day, cable television was the poor cousin to broadcast television. Nobody really paid much attention to it because it was seen as a niche phenomenon. But and this was in Argentina. So if cable television was seen as a niche, even though here in the U.S. by then already around half the people in America had it, back in Argentina, probably 5% of people had it. I still saw a potential. I still saw a future in how consumers were going from to move from broad audiences to fragmented audiences. So the audience was going to fragment, and there was an opportunity in organizing that fragmentation. I see the exact same opportunity in podcasting today. It's around half the people have never heard of the word podcast.
Really?
Two-thirds of the people have never listened to a podcast. So there's only 17% of people like us that listen to a podcast on a monthly basis. But we listen so much that it's a big number in total hours. It's 8 billion listener hours. And the opportunity is to organize, essentially to create a marketplace where more creators come to the platform, more advertisers come to the platform, and then...
You're building an infrastructure. It's like the Wild West out there, and you're building an infrastructure so that people can get from A to B.
Oh, here, I just thought of this. TV, you had to be home. You had to be sitting in front of a couch. Podcast, you can listen to every other hour of the day.
Well, this is what you actually, when we were at call, you said a stat that blew my mind.
Right.
How many people in the world have a TV?
73%.
And how many people will have a phone?
80% by the end of this decade.
By the end of this decade.
In the whole world.
In the whole world.
But that never happened with computers. Today is 50%, but not a phone.
Computers is 50%?
No, today smartphone is 50%. By the way, 80% of people have a smartphone, not any phone. I think the number of people who have any phone will be closer to 90. But a smartphone, which is the device that today is turning into the first screen, will be in hands of 80% of the people by the end of the decade. So there's a lot of things that we do with our phones. We check our phones on average 300 times a day. And it's becoming the first, that's on average. So some
I'm
people,
higher. 100%
I probably check it 500 plus. Some people check it twice a day.
I'm sure I'm up there as well.
But more and more of our media time will move to the mobile, the smartphone, what I call the personal screen. And I wanted to be in a business that leveraged the growth of that personal screen. And I looked at other opportunities. I looked at mobile gaming and looked at short form video. And I didn't see anything. They're all great businesses, by the way. But I didn't see anything that I could do in those spaces that hadn't already been done.
But there's a personal connection for you with radio, isn't there?
There is. There is as well.
Will you share a little bit about that personal, that your connection to it?
Well, it's double. My first job was in radio, in radio and cable. So this company that owned a radio cable system in Argentina. But even before that, when I went to communications school, I left school to run to a pirate radio station in order to have my own radio show with five. Four colleagues from school, some of them from college and some of them from high school. And I thought it was interesting reflecting back that pirate radio is a predecessor to podcasting. Pirate radio, I don't know if it ever existed here in the U.S.
I don't know what's happening right now.
Pirate radio, I think, did exist, but I think that not many people
pirates
know
are Somalians, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know any other pirate.
But pirate radio essentially happened out of the same desire of people to express themselves that gave rise to podcasting, right? Podcasting starts from audio blogs turning into audio, blogs turn into audio, and blogs themselves come from people that want to create a platform that goes beyond the traditional media companies and beyond the traditional editor desks. Pirate radio essentially was a bunch of pirates, people going and setting up an antenna and a transmitter, transmission desk, and renting the space out to people like me and other people that would go and have their own weekly show and then sell the space to advertisers. Very much like
it's exactly what we're doing here. I mean, we bring mics and a computer,
exactly,
and we record.
And just as few people are listening.
So you were doing this pirate radio. Now I'm curious. This is back in Argentina.
This is back in Argentina. I was 18. I don't know, 18 or 19, but it was. It only lasted 3 months. Because I had a job, then communication school at night, and then at 11 p.m. was the time, every Thursday, I remember, because the show was called 11 and 5. 11 p.m. was the show.
I have an image about pirate radio and that kind of thing as being very subversive. It was like talking about the political landscape. It would be stuff that like maybe couldn't be talked about on mainstream radio. Is that true? Is that a part of that culture?
Well, anybody could get there so long as you paid a fee to rent the airtime. So, yes, you have things that you couldn't talk about, and you have shows of quality that, were just getting started, so they wouldn't have a space on commercial radio. Right, so that's where the parallel, I think, with podcasting is all over the place.
I would like to shift.
The biggest difference is that in podcasting today, you can actually create a platform and you can have millions of listeners, which in pirate radio you never could.
Yeah. We've seen an explosion in podcasting in the last few years. I think like with Serial, I think probably is the public face of the explosion of podcasting.
You know, a funny side note is we tried to listen to Serial like a fireside chat. We were like, I got my family together, my cousins and uncles and aunts. They were like, this is going to be great. Like a nice family thing, and then immediately they start talking about having sex with each other and doing drugs, and we're like, let's just stop that. This is Indian family. Let's pretend this never happened.
There was a lot of that in pirate radio.
I would like to take a shift to the personal for a second, and you left Argentina to come to the States in your 27. What was your desire to leave Argentina and come to the States?
It was partially out of a desire to have a career that transcended the country, transcended Argentina. I think part of me felt that I had already reached a job that was too senior for my age, and also being gay, I felt I had reached the gay glass ceiling. And there was an opportunity at Fox that allowed me to go to work at a big company and at the same time move to the U.S.
Now, was there an image of the U.S. as a space where, because this idea when you talk about an entrepreneur, that feels like such an American dream kind of mentality. And I'm curious, did America represent the space for that for you?
I did not know it at the time. I thought of the U.S. First, I had very little knowledge of the U.S. Up until I was 25, I had never even been to the U.S.
Right.
You know, in Argentina, you grow up to hate the U.S. as much as, obviously, in other countries, they hate Britain, right?
Everywhere else in the world.
They look at the U.S. That this was then, at the time. Argentina.
Well, I'm surprised to hear that about Argentina.
This was then, not now, not now the case at all. But back then, you also have to be mindful. This was not that long after the dirty war of the 70s, where people associated the political, the dictatorship with U.S. support. Right. So there was a lot going on in there. But I first time I set my foot in the U.S., I said, I absolutely love this. Look at, the streets are clean and the buildings are beautiful and everything works. And I hear that people here progress and get employed and are promoted based on what they do, not who they know or what school they went to. I love that idea. In Argentina, I felt that it was a combination of luck, connections, and influence. And some people actually did make it, but I already felt that by 27 I had just made it as far as I could.
Well, one of the big questions we had for you that was interesting was that you've exploded this ceiling that you reached. I mean, you've reached the pinnacle of success with Fox and now are starting a company. Like, you have essentially had the American dream that we all talk about and in a lot of ways that we believe is lost at this time. I'm wondering if you could speak to what allows for that in America that wasn't present in Argentina.
At the time, at least. It was a combination, I think, of a very strong meritocratic culture. So in America, by and large, efforts are rewarded with results, by and large.
Immigrants have that mentality way more than people who are born here.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because that's a really good point, because I find that a lot of the people that I talk to that were born here.
Right.
And just a lot of people that I talk to, and maybe it's a remnant of our generation today, do not agree with that thought.
Right.
They believe that business and getting jobs is more about who you know. And not just in the acting and entertainment industry, but in like the business world, the people that I've talked to. That's a really interesting thing. Disagree with that notion.
I disagree with that. But I think I'm saying it the way I saw it when I was 27 relative to Argentina. I saw that very clearly.
Right.
Just from the point of view of the kind of question they could ask at an interview, right? And remember that leave Argentina being, 27 and gay and feeling that it was fair game for anybody at the time in Argentina to ask you those questions. How old are you?
Really?
Do you have a girlfriend?
Right?
So the fact that I go to the U.S. without knowing, but don't even think about the fact that they don't ask me the question. The first time they give me HR training as a manager, when I start having people reporting to me about a couple of months later, let's say, you're not allowed to ask a question, you're not allowed to ask that question, why is that? And then they explain to me, and it makes perfect sense.
So yeah, wow, that's an amazing, you have the perspective of that, and that's where I think that it's so important to travel and be in other places in the world, is because you understand like the benefits, like the gratitude of what we have is that, yeah, sure, we may not have it perfectly here that it's a meritocracy, but like spaces are much worse about it and were. I mean, I know India is still bad about that.
Can you talk more about the gay glass ceiling that you experienced in Argentina? Like, expound more upon that?
I essentially saw that everybody, I didn't know any other gay person who had a position of seniority in my company or any other company. And I just saw that all my colleagues who were gay kind of lingered out and were always passed over for promotions. And there was this unspoken discrimination where, we'll never, call you, a nasty word to your face, but you'll never get promoted.
Was it something that is talked about? Like here, you always hear about glass ceilings for women, for whoever. Was it talked about in Argentina, or was it just like?
It wasn't talked about because we were all large in the closet. I was one of the rare people that was not in the closet.
Okay.
But most of my friends were. Again, you got to remember this is also not only just Argentina, it's also 20 years ago.
For sure.
Yeah. But that's interesting to understand. Like, can you talk a little bit about your decision to be open about that? I mean, that's to me courageous as well.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear more of like how you decided and how you felt like you had the strength to do that.
I just went to therapy, which is one of the good things that Argentina has that not many other countries do,
right?
Early enough in life to know that my being gay was not a choice and is nothing that I should ever feel ashamed of or ever should have any doubt. And if anybody had a problem about my being gay, the problem was theirs, not me, right? So that's something that I learned very early, not too early, but, at 19, so early enough to give me confidence when I had conversations. And then I realized that a lot of people, a lot of my friends, had to spend so much energy remembering what story they told home.
Wow.
That I said I didn't want to. I mean, you need to be authentic. You just cannot try to keep tabs of who knows what, right? So I figured I wasn't going out and bragging to people about it, but if somebody asked me, then I would tell them the truth.
That's fat. I mean, I think that's such an important lesson, and I think that's such a huge gift to hear about, because I think it's true. I think the more that we allow people to just be truly who they are, they can not get caught up in that mess and that noise of like, because so much energy gets distracted in like hiding
energy
that can't really let themselves fully out.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm wondering about this. We talk about one of the problems in the South Asian culture is homophobia.
Mm-hmm.
And India recently, I mean, India itself is still in a dark place with it because they've, anti-homosexuality laws have been put back on the books. I have this perception, and Akash and I have talked about this, that What you were saying, that the only group of people that you think that are more homophobic than Indians are black folk.
Oh, yeah.
And then...
My perception is there's no one more homophobic than Indians except black people, and there's no one more homophobic than black people except Latinos.
I don't think you're right. In general, I don't like generalizations, right? But I'm on the board of GLAAD, so... What I'm glad is the main advocate organization promoting equality and acceptance, and we work through the through essentially the promotion of positive messages, and also as acting as a watchdog every time that something that is we don't agree with is said. So I gotta be careful to say that what I'm going to say now are my views and not necessarily the views of GLAAD, but. We've seen different biases. We've studied different biases among different communities, and the differences between among the communities are much larger than the difference across communities, if that makes sense. So, in other words,
factors. So, like,
so the other factors is it has much more to do with what you learn when you're a kid, right? I mean, that homophobia and that homophobia can be turned around. Can be turned around by essentially getting people. To know that the single most important factor is knowing somebody who's personally part of your circle,
right.
Who's gay and open, who's LGBT, right, and open.
Exposure. We talk about this a lot. About
that's the single most important factor.
When we talk about the shame that we all felt, you know, being South Asian in like growing up in, you know, he grew up in Texas around like, you know, he was in a very concentrated, he was like, felt very isolated. Me growing up in Tampa felt very isolated from like the other South Asians in the world. And there was such shame about that. And we've learned in this podcast that exposure is what can allow you to take away that shame.
Right.
And like people that have like, oh, we weren't alone.
Right.
So yeah, my experience or what I'm seeing, I think, is kids now are exposed to so much more that generally speaking, it's decreasing, like homophobia, racism, et cetera.
Right.
Like, in a large sense. Now, have you gone back to Argentina, and do you get the same sense in Argentina?
That is decreased a lot, absolutely.
That's
absolutely,
awesome.
Yes, absolutely.
And do you think the main thing, would you equate it mainly to exposure?
It is. Exposure, and then the more people that you know, and the more... because people are, when the homophobia typically comes from fear of the unknown.
Right.
Yeah.
It comes from you
most
don't know...
Hate.
Most fears, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fear that is, or comes from a place of not knowing, and that's replaced by a narrative or replaced by a myth.
Right.
So when you replace the myth with the actual knowledge of a person, then the phobia typically goes away. Not always, but it does.
Well, we only have a few minutes left with you, so I want to ask this question that we like to ask sometimes. This is a podcast essentially about identity.
Yes.
At the end of the day, this podcast is really about like who we are, and it's.
Very,
in my mind, it's very universal. How do you identify? Do you identify as still Argentinian? Do you identify as American? Do you identify as both? Where do you fall in that spectrum for yourself?
I have both passports. So I have my American passport and my Argentinian passport. I'm very proud of both.
Right.
But I tend to identify more with America today because I spend more time here as an adult than in Argentina. I love Argentina. My whole family is in Argentina still. But I speak English at home, and I dream in English. And
that's a fascinating.
That's something that's happened. That usually tells you when you've made the switch, when you have acculturated, it's when you started dreaming in the language of the country where you are.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I'd never heard that before.
Right. Well, you don't know
I dream. That's true. I do pretend like I know a lot. So is my follow-up to that, is America home now?
It is home.
Is LA home?
LA is home as well.
Wow.
What's not to like?
That's a different guy. I'm. I don't. Oh, okay. Ugh, now I have to explain it.
Shut up. We don't need to hear you more interviews.
While you were talking, it reminded me of a question that actually you presented to me as that was a very good question to ask. And so I would like to end with this. The question is: what are you running to right now?
I'm running to creating a new way of telling stories. It's a way that existed in the past. In some respects, it's the oldest form of storytelling. People have been telling stories with a voice for 15,000 years, probably.
Wow.
Way longer than theater, way longer than print, way longer than books, way longer than television or film.
15,000 doesn't even seem that long.
It's a long time.
History.
How long have humans been around?
And that's why telling stories with your voice feels natural to your inner brain. And that's why I believe there's an opportunity to bring that very natural, time-tested form of storytelling back to the mobile age. That's what I'm running towards.
I love that. I've talked about it's in our tribes. The wise men of a tribe, wise men or wise women, were the ones that told the stories. They held the oral traditions. The Mahabharata and the Ramayana, two of the Hindu epics, were orally told for generations.
For as long as humans have been around, we've had to lie to our significant others. And those are really just stories. You know what I mean? Like, if you get down to it, we've been telling stories for as long as ever.
We've been telling stories forever. Hernan, we want to thank you so much for joining the show this week. And we are so excited for Wondria and all of the exciting stories that you're going to be bringing to light. Is there a website? Is there a way people can start reaching for Wondria at this moment?
It is wondria.com. We are now in the process of creating our first shows and attracting talent, and I'm talking to writers and people in advertising sales and the like, so we don't have any shows on air yet to promote, but as soon as we have the first one, I'll come to you to promote it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Guys, we're gonna be back next week with more content, but you know, we always want to hear your tweets. We want to hear what you're thinking about. What's going on in your head? You guys dropped us tweets about Coldplay, so next time let's do better with some more interesting topics. I've really taken on Akash's role today.
I know. I don't know what to do. I don't know what's going on.
I think you have to be the good cop here.
No, hey guys, we would really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the podcast, review the podcast, rate the podcast, give us 5 stars, please. Also, Wondery.com, check it out, but don't stop listening to this podcast because you get too caught up in what's on Wondery. You know what I mean? That's your second favorite place to go to for podcasts now.
All right, guys, we'll catch you in a couple days. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash. God bless.